Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Pyongyang said the government will launch a new round of talks on electoral reform, but offered no time frame for those talks. As he spoke, riot police barricaded streets around government offices to block throngs of protesters launching the mass protest demanding the democratic reforms for the former British colony. Organizers say their Occupy Central with Love and Peace has now officially begun. Airstrikes hit oil refineries near Syria's border with Turkey early today in the international action against Islamic State militants. A U.S.-led military coalition has targeted several facilities in the last week to stop the flow of millions of dollars in daily oil production revenue to the group, which has taken over parts of Syria and Iraq in recent months. The coalition now says the targeting of those production facilities again today was in fact successful. The U.S. Defense Department said that warplanes yesterday struck a northern Syrian town under militant siege for 2 weeks. Liberia's chief medical officer has put herself under a 3-week quarantine after the death of one of her assistants from Ebola virus. Bernice Don told reporters Saturday she has no symptoms, but she wants to make sure she's not infected. She's also asked members of her staff to stay home for 21 days, which is the maximum incubation period for the virus. The World Health Organization on Friday reported 150 people in Liberia dead of the virus in just 2 days. More than 1,800 have died in Liberia since the beginning of the outbreak, with a total of 3,100 in all countries. This is VOA News. Shiite rebels in Yemen have signed a security deal stipulating disarmament and withdrawal from areas seized in recent months. The agreement was signed one day after the rebels, known as the Houthis, overran much of the capital of Sana'a. The deal is part of a comprehensive agreement brokered by the UN and includes rivals such as the Muslim Brotherhood-linked ISLA party. The State Department says the U.S. is stepping up efforts to work with the international community to pursue sanctions against individuals who are threatening Yemen's peace, stability, and security. African conflicts were under the spotlight this weekend at the UN General Assembly. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the United Nations.
At the General Assembly annual debate, the Central African Republic's transitional president, Catherine Samba Panza, spoke of the sectarian violence that has displaced hundreds of thousands in her country this year. She welcomed the deployment this month of 7,000 UN peacekeepers. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon hosted a high-level meeting on the conflict in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir failed to show up at the session, but touched on the political problems between himself and rival Riek Machar, telling the General Assembly that his rival had staged a coup. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Libya's internationally recognized parliament in Tobruk has sworn in the government of Prime Minister Abdullah Al-Thani. Mr. Al-Thani's government has little influence outside of Tobruk, where parliament moved after a militia from the city of Misrata seized Tripoli and set up a rival government there during the worst violence in the country since the 2011 overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi. Russia, being hit with stiff Western sanctions for its role in the Ukraine crisis, accused the United States and the European Union on Saturday of backing a coup d'etat that drove Ukraine's pro-Russian president from power early this year. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in an address to the UN General Assembly, said Washington has openly declared its right to unilateral use of force, and in his words, is trying to decide for everyone what is good and evil. This latest address is just more evidence of deteriorating ties between Moscow and the West. Police in central Japan say they have found the bodies of more than 30 hikers near the summit of Mount Onatake, a volcano that erupted Saturday without warning. Officials have not confirmed the deaths, but rescuers described the victims as being in a state of cardiac arrest. Japanese authorities often use that term to describe the dead until doctors can examine the bodies. Hundreds of Japanese police and military troops descended on the ash-covered slopes of the mountain this morning looking for survivors. They found one person to rescue and said other hikers were seriously injured. And President Barack Obama says the widespread mistrust of law enforcement in the United States, exposed after the fatal shooting last month of an unarmed black teenager by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, is corroding the country. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Peace and stability must return to Mali so that refugees may return to their homes, so that human rights may be protected.
The UN General Assembly discusses conflicts in Africa.
We want the UN to take a critical look at the insecurity situation and the insurgency in Nigeria with the expected immediacy.
A major Nigeria NGO calls for the United Nations intervention to end the country's security crisis.
This will not be mass vaccination campaign, let's be clear about that, because the quantity of vaccine which will be available.
Will there be an Ebola vaccine early next year as predicted? We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. African conflicts came under the spotlight at the UN General Assembly, including at a special high-level meeting on Mali. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon opened a special session on Mali, saying the international community had come together to support the country's political process because it is the key to Mali's stability. Mr. Ban addressed the summit in French and is heard here through an interpreter.
Peace and stability must return to Mali so that refugees may return to their homes, so that human rights may be protected, and so that public services may be re-established.
He warned that the security situation remains extremely fragile, particularly in the north, where fighting among armed groups has continued despite agreements to stop. Meeting participants, which included the French foreign minister, expressed strong support for peace talks underway in Algiers between the government and rebel groups. Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, said obstacles to peace are surmountable with political willingness from both sides. He's heard here through an interpreter.
The government of Mali is prepared to discuss any option which could find the best institutional formula for shared governance and which would promote the effective, genuine development of the communities concerned.
At the General Assembly annual debate, the Central African Republic's transitional president, Catherine Samba Panza, spoke of the sectarian violence that has displaced hundreds of thousands in her country this year. She welcomed the deployment this month of 7,000 UN peacekeepers. Ms. Samba Panza said security gains require strong national security and defense forces. She's heard here through an interpreter asking for a review of the arms embargo against her country.
I should hear like to ask for the understanding of the Sanctions Commission to ensure that the arms embargo imposed on the Central African Republic be reassessed and re-examined.
On Thursday, UN Chief Ban hosted a high-level meeting on the conflict in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir failed to show up at the session, but touched on the political problems between himself and rival Riek Machar, telling the General Assembly that his rival had staged a coup. China, which has extensive investments in South Sudan's oil industry, expressed its concern about the continuing instability. Foreign Minister Wang Yi is heard here through an interpreter.
The two sides of the conflict in South Sudan should immediately effect a ceasefire, actively conduct political dialogue in the overall interests of the people in South Sudan, and through the mediation of IGAD, work with all ethnic groups and parties in the country to speedily reach a fair and balanced solution and achieve national reconciliation and ethnic unity.
The United Nations warned this week that 4 million South Sudanese are food insecure and 50,000 children could die before the end of the year if the violence does not stop. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Meanwhile, Nigeria Unite, a non-governmental organization, has called for United Nations intervention to help Abuja resolve Nigeria's security challenges following increased attacks by Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Nigeria Unite held a series of protests at the UN General Assembly in New York, demanding immediate action. Pastor Peter Ichelu, a leading member of Nigeria Unite, says it appears the administration in Abuja has been unable to end the violence in spite of numerous efforts to do so. Ichelu told me earlier that if not halted, Nigeria's security challenges could spread to neighboring countries in both West and Central African regions.
We want the UN to take a critical look at the insecurity situation and the insurgency in Nigeria with the expected immediacy, because one problem in Nigeria can engulf the whole of Africa. And that is our concern, that there should be an immediate intervention. It should not be looked upon as a Nigerian situation. It is an African situation. It is a world situation.
The international community, including the U.S. And some Western countries, have pledged support and are helping your country's government to address some of these insecurity challenges.
No, it is not enough. We cannot sleep on our oars. The insurgents themselves have to feel the pressure. They have to know that we may not have weapons to fight them, but we are fighting them with pressure. They too will be pressurized that we're not sleeping on our oars. They should know that we are concerned that our country is precious to us and that we are attacking them with our emotions. This is very important to us.
Are you saying that Nigeria's military, hitherto respected in West Africa and globally, are incapable of handling this insurgency?
To be very frank with you, Nigeria was asleep. We have been asleep. Our leadership has been asleep. Our citizens have been complacent and in compromise. And to be very honest with you, we were asleep. This problem has awakened us, and we want all Nigerians to be united to fight insurgency. You see, insurgents capitalize on disunity. They capitalize on local problems. And so they took advantage of our disunity when politicians came and tried to divide us along ethnic, religious, and whatever lines that they chose to break us up and divide and rule us. And the insurgents capitalized on this and got into the country. When a country is one, no insurgency can penetrate. But they took advantage of a weak society, a divided society, and the people who were at daggers drawn with one another.
The person who purports to be Shakao, who releases videos taunting Nigerians and the world, has reportedly been killed with photographs being shown all along. Don't you think that this is a first step as part of efforts to address this insecurity caused by Boko Haram in the country?
No, Shakao is just a shadow of Boko Haram. It's not the real thing. The real thing must be addressed. And the real thing is in diverse dimensions. And that is why we are going to continue with the pressure. Whether 20 Shakaos are killed in a day, it does not solve the problem. We want insurgency to be completely routed out and for Nigerians to be united and for development, real development, to kickstart.
Pastor Peter Ichelu is leading member of Nigeria Unite, a Nigeria-based NGO. He spoke with me from New York. Thousands of protesters have called on the Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila to step down when his term of office expires in 2016. The protesters say lawmakers from the ruling party want to amend the constitution to remove term limit that would pave the way for Mr. Kabila to run for a third term. The protest in the capital, Kinshasa, was peaceful. However, police dispersed demonstrators in Goma with tear gas. Fidel Bafalimba is a researcher with the U.S.-based ENAF project in the eastern DRC town of Goma, and he joins us live via telephone link-up. Hello, Fidel.
Hello, sir.
Well, Fidel, how did the protest turn violent? Because officials are saying that the police were forced to disperse the protesters.
Well, here in Goma, it has been really chaotic. The police had come in strong force and dispersed everyone. They didn't allow people to peacefully demonstrate, as it was the case in Kinshasa. Decidedly, President Joseph Kabila seems to be in for another term, because here back in the country, most of his citizens were expecting him to break the silence and announce to the world that he's going to abide by the Constitution, step down in 2016 as required by the Constitution. But instead, he came up with smokescreen statement about key security and development, which is not concrete to the people.
Now, Fidel, the government has repeatedly said that although it has given some amendment, you know, moves in the lawmaking body, they have specifically not put forward measures to basically remove term limits. So why are the people protesting if such a move has yet to be made in the lawmaking body?
So this has been a long-time practice by the ruling party in Congo. In 2011, for instance, Kabila's party had to review the constitution in a way that allowed him to be the only winner. And this time, it has been made clear by top bosses, prominent members of his political party, that they need to review the constitution. So this is clear to me. And while President Kabila himself hasn't asked that, but his silence is interpreted largely by most people here as consistent to the will of his political parties.
The government has said that these protesters, including opposition figures, failed repeatedly to inform the police of their intention to protest. And that is why the police would sometimes, or security agencies would sometimes have to ensure that, you know, stability and security is ensured in parts of the country. Is that why there appear to be a clash between the security agencies and the protesters?
Well, basically, if the security device of the ruling party was itself acting as democratically required in a democratic republic of the Congo, as it's called, I mean, the constitutional law for free protest demonstration provides that somebody tells the authorities, and to the knowledge of most people here is that the political party who planned to post it, to demonstrate, they had announced, they had made it public that they're going to do it. So, and you can see it was allowed to happen in Kinshasa, but it was denied to happen in Goma. So I don't think it is for security reasons that the police had to step in, but I think they needed to hinder the democratic process by, because it was not only opposition parties, but it included even civil society organizations.
Thank you very much. That was Fidel Bafilimba, a researcher with the US-based ENAF project. He spoke with me from the eastern DRC town of Goma. The Guinean student who traveled to Senegal and became the country's lone confirmed case of Ebola has returned home fully recovered. The incident highlighted the difficulty in trying to contain the outbreak, even though Senegal had closed its borders with Guinea. Karim Kamara in the Guinean capital Conakry caught up with the student and filed this report for VOA.
Mamadou Ali Mojalo says he went to Senegal in August to see his uncle and to inquire about attending school there. He tells VOA he did not know he was sick at the time. He says he felt nothing until 48 hours after arrival in Dakar, when the first symptoms appeared. He began vomiting. He says when he felt worse over the course of the week, he asked his uncle to take him to the hospital, and that is where they told him he had Ebola. Jalo recalls feeling sad as he didn't know if he would survive. But when he started feeling better after a few days, he was hopeful he had recovered. The Ebola outbreak started in Guinea in December and has since spread to four other countries. While Nigeria and Senegal seem to have contained the spread, the disease continues to kill scores of people each week in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The United Nations has declared Ebola an international threat to security and is mobilizing global donations and medical expertise. Jalo's ability to cross a closed border raised alarm bells, but his case appears isolated and no one else in Senegal had contracted the vicious disease, which is killing about 50% of those infected in this current outbreak. Jalo returned to Guinea's capital Conakry last week. He says he was happy to be home, but the happiness was short-lived when he was told some of his family was not as lucky as he was. He says his mother and sister died at the Donga Hospital here in Conakry. My mother and sister, he repeats, his two younger brothers, we are also treated at the Donga Hospital and they are now home. Mamadou Alimu is back at home with them, recovered from Ebola but still scared by its devastating impact. Karim Kamara, VOA News, Conakry.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, or WHO, reports that a couple of promising anti-Ebola vaccines may be ready for use in heavily affected West African countries early next year. WHO says work on other potentially life-saving experimental therapies is also underway. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The Ebola epidemic is ravaging parts of West Africa. The World Health Organization considers it the most severe public health emergency in the world today. But there are no vaccines or medicines to prevent or cure this disease, which is killing about 50% of people it infects. Given this emergency, WHO experts have agreed it is ethically acceptable to use experimental medicines and vaccines to try to combat Ebola. Work is underway to assess the safety of several possible vaccines. WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says results from these safety tests will be known by the end of the year, and if all goes well, two candidate vaccines might start to be used in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia in early January.
This will not be mass vaccination campaign, let's be clear about that, because the quantity of vaccine which will be available doesn't make this possible. But we will discuss next week with experts what would be the best target in terms of the first person to be offered the vaccine. This would be under informed consent. Of course, this vaccine, none of the vaccine would be licensed. So this is part of a sort of emergency or compassionate use that was described in the and discussed with experts.
Dr. Kini tells VOA healthcare and frontline workers are being considered as candidates for the vaccines. She adds the vaccines might also be offered to contacts of people known to have Ebola, depending on how many doses are available.
What we will have to do very soon is start working with the community and have community mobilization. You know that there is the situation, the political situation is quite unstable. The population are very vulnerable. There is some violence. They don't understand what is happening. So it will be very important that the community, through the community leaders, are brought on board.
Dr. Kini says there is growing interest in the use of safe whole blood or plasma transfusions from recovered Ebola patients to treat those who are sick. She says not enough people have been treated with this therapy to know whether it is effective. However, she says there is anecdotal evidence of people having survived because of this treatment.
But there is a lot of enthusiasm indeed, because this is something which is available on site. This is something where the African population don't have to wait for anybody else to develop it for them. So this is why there is a lot of enthusiasm.
Dr. Kini says volunteer donors will have to be screened to make sure their blood is free of the Ebola virus. She says these tests are routinely used in the field. WHO reports 6,242 people are infected with Ebola, including more than 2,900 killed. It says these figures are far greater than those from all previous Ebola outbreaks combined. Yet it warns even these large figures vastly underestimate the true scale of the epidemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa's Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa is scheduled to meet senior officials in Lesotho's coalition government Tuesday to try to help resolve political disagreements that have created tension and instability in the Southern African kingdom, according to Hwabani Theko, Chief Whip of Lesotho Senate. Theko said Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane has too much power stipulated in the constitution, but he rejected calls for an amendment that would empower King Leti III to help resolve political disagreements. Earlier today, I reached Theko in the capital, Maseru, for his analytical comments.
Because of the coalition nature of government, there's also a problem between our Prime Minister and his deputy, who is from the other party in this coalition. So the issue of consultation was not really taken well, because in our constitution, there's nowhere where the Prime Minister is obliged maybe to consult when he does anything to his partner in the coalition. So we're still having that problem, sir, on the ground.
How are Basotho taking this stalemate, and how best can this be resolved?
It is very unsettling indeed, because nobody is sure what is going to happen. There's been an attempted coup, which was very clear. Now, that has really made the people very unsettled on our political spectrum. And lastly, I might say, it's not settled until Tamudi himself really relinquishes power and maybe make way for the gentleman who is entering, who is known as Mr. or Lieutenant General Maaparangwe Mahau. So we are having that problem at the moment. So Basotho are very unsettled. There's so much uncertainty, and of course the business is really not doing well because of this. Every time it's 6 o'clock in the evening, everybody wants to get to his own household to make sure that he does not meet a bullet or something like that.
Some people are proposing that perhaps there should be a constitutional amendment that would strengthen the king to take certain measures to restore law and order, as well as maintain the country's territorial integrity and stability in the country. What is your assessment on that?
Well, yes, we still have that. The king is supported by the Council of State, which, of course, consists a lot of people from higher offices, like the general himself, police commissioner, member of opposition, and other officials like the attorney general and all that. So we just need to maybe to have that group have some teeth so that they can help whenever there's a problem and have some certain powers of saying, no, the buck will last here or will stay with us whenever there's a problem. But right now, it is the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister alone, and of course with these other people who are realistically very trusted people who are very near him. So most of the power is now with the Prime Minister. But I would hate to see a monarch who can take that, because I do not want to put the monarchy in danger. I don't want to see my king being behaved like Charles I in England in the older times.
Are you therefore saying that there's too much power that resides constitutionally with the Prime Minister?
Definitely so. I don't think he can even deny that himself, the incumbent Prime Minister.
As a leading member in the Senate, what are the senators saying? What are they doing about this? Despite SADC efforts to resolve this stalemate, it appears the stalemate is not going anywhere. So what are you doing as a lawmaking body to help resolve this impasse?
We have really suggested to the facilitator, the deputy president of South Africa, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa. We've made some suggestions, and he's coming weekly into the city. So the ball is still rolling. Well, very, very, maybe slowly for others, but there are so many other things that has to be changed in the Constitution itself and other laws that will rule whenever we have a coalition in our government.
So are you going to propose that amendment if things become stable so that there are laws governing coalition government, in future?
Definitely, that's our. But now there are lots of people who are very much in the hurry to open the parliament so that they can call for motion of no confidence against the incumbent Prime Minister, which I think is a very quick solution that cannot help Basotho at all. So where we are now is maybe to take the working document which Dr. Prasad from New Zealand, who was sent by the Commonwealth to come and help us maybe to straighten out things. So there are those proposals of trying to inhibit what we call cross-flowing, which brings a lot of conflict among the MPs. That's the first thing. Now, one of the issues that he really did sell in his proposal was that to have a very professional and not affiliated kind of civil service. That is to say, very loyal to any government that comes into power, which I know is very difficult in many states, of course.
Hwaba Nitheko is Chief Whip of Lesotho Senate. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, September 28th. Let's blast off with athletics. The marathon world record has been smashed. Kenya's Dennis Kimeto broke the record today, Sunday, at the BMW Berlin Marathon with a time of 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds. As Africans dominated the race, Kimeto's time slashed 26 seconds off the previous mark, set at the same race last year by another Kenyan, Wilson Kipson. Fellow Kenyan Emmanuel Mutai came second, also inside the previous world record, with his time of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 13 seconds. Ethiopia's Sabera Kuma was a distant third in 2 hours, 5 minutes and 56 seconds. Kimeto's performance in the German capital also bettered the fastest time ever achieved on any marathon course, surpassing the 2 hours, 3 minutes and 2 seconds clocked by fellow Kenyan Jeffrey Mutai in 2011. African runners also finished first and second in the women's race. Ethiopian Terfi Segaye won in 2 hours, 20 minutes and 18 seconds, while compatriot Feise Tadese was second in 2 hours, 20 minutes and 27 seconds. Congratulations are in order for Kimeto and the other African runners. After the race, the energetic Andy Edwards spoke with the new marathon world record holder.
We're talking with the man who's just made marathon history, Dennis Kimeto, who has won the BMW Berlin Marathon 2014. Not only has he won it, not only has he broken the world record, he is the first man ever to break 2 hours and 3 minutes for the marathon. Dennis, first question, very simple. How does it feel to make history in the marathon?
I'm feeling good for this race. For now, I am happy for a world record.
Is this a dream for you? You know, you've only been running for, 6 years? Is it a dream come true?
Yeah, but now it's running for just 9 marathon. But I am happy. And I expected to put again world record.
In the race, did you think, were you confident that you could break the world record?
Yeah, in the race, yeah, you will see the people inside. He was cheer me, but then, I think he was, mine was it. I put the world record.
You know, people have talked, when will 2 hours, 3 minutes be broken? And most people thought, well, a few years away, not now. But for you, you seem so relaxed and confident about it. Is that true, that your training was so good that you thought you could do this?
Yeah, after that come here, I training good.
Just one more question, Dennis. You're now the world record holder. Do you think, and you're still quite young, do you think, especially in your running career, do you think you can break the world record again?
Yeah, I expect to run the record again. Maybe next year I can come here to put again the world record.
Well, fantastic. I think all of us just stand back in awe of what you've achieved. Dennis Kimeto of Kenya, the new world record holder and champion of the BMW Berlin Marathon 2014. Dennis, fantastic day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Many thanks for the interview, Andy. Away from athletics, AS Vita Football Club of the Democratic Republic of Congo has cruised into the final of the 2014 African Champions League. The Congolese club turned favorite CS Sfaxien of Tunisia 2-1 at its own backyard in Sfax in the semi-final return leg match on Saturday. The Kinshasa-based club advanced 4-2 on aggregate and will face either local rival TP Mazembe or ES Setif of Algeria in next month's final. It is the first time since 1981 that the Black Dolphins, as AS Vita is known, had reached the final of a major continental club championship. Since winning the title in 1973, AS Vita has not succeeded in laying its hands on a continental silverware. As for the Tunisian club, it has failed in its bid to win successive African club titles following its 2013 triumph in the CAF Confederation Cup. Meanwhile, AS Vita player Ndombe Mubele is among the two leading scorers at this stage of the CAF Champions League. Mubele has scored 6 goals, just like 3 other players. However, only one of the 3 players, Alhaji Balemiri of AS Setif, remains in the tournament, going into his club's semi-final match against TP Mazembe later today, Sunday. The lucrative CAF Champions League offers $1.5 million to the winner, $1 million to the runner-up, and some good money for every team that reached the group stage. The winner of the tournament also qualifies for the FIFA Club World Cup, a tournament contested by the champion clubs from all 6 continental confederations. Al Ahly of Egypt won the 2013 edition of the Premier African Club Football Tournament. The Egyptian team is the most successful in the history of the tournament, having won it a record 8 times. Turning to Africa's other club football competition, the CAF Confederation Cup, Sewe Sport of Ivory Coast became the first side to reach the final of the 2014 edition of the competition, after holding AC Leopards of Congo to a goalless draw on Saturday in Dolise. The Ivorians booked their place 1-0 on aggregate, thanks to a long goal victory in the first leg last week in Abidjan. Sewe Sport becomes the first Ivorian side since 1998 to reach the final of a major continental club championship, after rival ASEC Mimosas beat Dynamos of Zimbabwe to win the CAF Champions League 16 years ago. Sewe Sport will meet either Egyptian giant Al Ahly or Cotton Sport of Cameroon in the final. The winner of the CAF Confederation Cup will pocket $660,000 and will also face the winner of the CAF Champions League in next year's CAF Super Cup. Now let's head to Windhoek, the capital city of Namibia, which will host next month's African Women's Championship. The Algerian team has become the first to arrive for the 9th edition of the tournament, scheduled for October 11th to 25th. The 38-member Algerian delegation, which includes 21 players, touched down in the early hours of today's Sunday at the Osea Kutako International Airport in Windhoek and was warmly received by officials of the local organizing committee. Algeria coach Azedin Chi said the team's early arrival is to allow the players to acclimatize and continue with the preparations for the tournament. The Algerians are expected to play 2 friendlies with the host team to fine-tune their preparations. Meanwhile, Ghana's team is expected to arrive in Namibia later today, Sunday, via South Africa. The 5 other teams, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, South Africa, and Zambia, are expected to arrive from October 7th, 4 days before the opening ceremony. Host Namibia, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, and Zambia are in Group A, while Algeria, Cameroon, Ghana, and South Africa make up Group B. The 3 top finishers at the tournament will represent Africa at the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. Meanwhile, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, South Africa, and Zambia have picked the tickets to the finals of the African Under-17 Championship to be hosted by Niger next year. In the return leg final qualifier on Saturday, Nigeria's Golden Eagles whitewashed Gabon 5-0 at the UJSUNS Sports Stadium in the southern city of Calabar. The victory gave Nigeria a 6-2 aggregate win after it lost 2-1 in the Gabonese capital, Libreville, a fortnight ago. In Abidjan, Ivory Coast humbled Angola 3-0 to go through 4-1 on aggregates. In Kampala, Zambia beat home team Uganda 2-1 on Saturday to advance 4-2 on aggregates. Elsewhere in Cairo, Egypt was held to a 2-2 draw by South Africa as the latter progressed 4-3 on aggregates. The 2015 African Under-17 tournament will take place from February 15th to March 1st, with the semi-final qualifying to represent Africa at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Chile later in the year. Finally, Victor Moses has been recalled to Nigeria's squad for 2 African Nations Cup ties against Sudan next month. Moses was a surprise omission from the squad that lost at home to Congo and drew away in South Africa in Nigeria's opening 2 Group A matches earlier this month. He has been recalled from the World Cup squad along with midfielders Raheem Lawal and Michael Babatunde, while English-born Hope Akpan of Reading was given its first call-up. African champion Nigeria is struggling in its bid to defend the title it won in 2013, having received only 1 point in its bid to qualify for the finals in Morocco in January. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. We'll be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time for music from the continent. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Bawa. Bomba, le propriétaire de tous les dossiers. Avec la participation de Jocelyne Berroa.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
At the current 69th session of the General Assembly of the United Nations, the general debate commenced last week with the first speaker, Brazil, as is customary, and followed by the host country, the President of the United States. Many African countries are attending this session of the General Assembly. The only ones not attending are the presidents of Liberia and Sierra Leone, who have wisely decided to stay home to take care of their citizens, given the Ebola crisis. In the first week of the general debate, where there are also many heads of states around the world participating, practically almost all heads of state, Africa was represented at the initial stage this week. And what happened was that instead of following the main issues that are reflected in the global media, such as Ukraine and the struggle against ISIS, they presented the narrative that is relevant to Africa. Not that they ignored the issue of Ukraine, but they feel that there should be more concentration on terrorism on the African continent, such as the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia, which is also affecting Kenya and Uganda, and of course the terrible actions of Boko Haram in Nigeria. they also look at the issue of ISIS and Ukraine in the sense that in Ukraine it may be the issue of occupation, but they then turned the spotlight on the Middle East and commented on the long occupation of Israel in Palestinian territory. They also condemned the violence in Gaza and the atrocity method to the Palestinian people in that territory. In a sense, what the Africans were doing, as well as a number of developing countries, is to present a different narrative that one will find in the Western media. They are of the view that issues such as the boat people, which was mentioned by the president of the Gambia, where large numbers of Africans have died on their way to seek greener pastures in Europe, should be given greater prominence. In fact, some African experts have always argued that the African Union should have taken up this issue and put it in the forefront. Now, the Gambian president said that Europeans should not forget that 400 years ago, when they came to colonize Africa, Africans welcomed the Europeans. And if they had treated them as they are now treating Africans, there would have been no colonialism. And then he made something of like a veiled threat that Africa can no longer tolerate the fact that immigrant boat people of Africans are being sunk, in his view, being sunk before they approach the European coast. The president of Zimbabwe customarily criticized, of course, the British and European Union for their sanctions, which he held responsible for the economic problems of his country. They also mentioned, these African leaders also mentioned, many of the economic difficulties they are now confronting. In this sense, the MDG, which will come to an end this year, and looking for next year, 2015, which has had a varied results. Some, in some cases, they have been successful, but by and large in Africa, the MDG goals have not been really successful. And they are now looking up to the new program in 2015 for economic development. When you turn to the main issue now facing Africa, Ebola, the president of Ghana, who is the current chairman of ECOWAS, the Economic Commission of West Africa, gave a fulsome presentation to the General Assembly. Prior to coming to the United Nations, he paid a visit to Sierra Leone, to Liberia, and to Guinea. So he was well informed. He regretted the fact that the international community was too slow in responding to this crisis. However, he said he had offered the services of Ghana and I'll discuss it with the Secretary General. And there is now an agreement that the UN will set up an office in the Ghanaian capital to help deal with the issue of the Ebola crisis. The general feeling one gets when listening to African leaders is that they are not too happy with the turn of events in the UN. They mentioned the Security Council, the fact that despite all of their efforts, there has not been any reform of the Security Council, and they urge reform. They also request that the General Assembly be revitalized. And in fact, the president of the General Assembly this year, which is the foreign minister of Uganda, has as a main agenda the revitalization of the General Assembly. So during this first week, we now see where the Africans are going And by and large, the views of the Africans are no different for many of the developing countries. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and sports editor Segun Adeyemi, as well as our engineer for today, Greg Burns, we say thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States cares about the Middle East because of the economic, political, and security interests we have, the many friendships we have formed, and the rich spiritual and ethnic traditions we have inherited. So it should not be surprising that we are both alarmed and moved to act by the upheaval that now roils these ancient lands, said Undersecretary for Political Affairs Wendy Sherman. America's policy in the Middle East begins with our understanding that the problems now plaguing the region have tangled roots.
Fear and anger drive too many people in too many places into the snare of zero-sum thinking, thereby fueling conflict and playing into the hands of all who would harm us. There is a need throughout the Middle East to change course and begin moving in the direction of common ground. But quite frankly, for that to happen, the region's leaders must live up to their responsibilities. The international community must put aside its divisions and exert a more positive influence. And the United States must help to show the way.
We reject the argument that intercultural and interreligious cooperation in the Middle East is an illusion. But we also understand that lasting stability without compromise is not possible, said Undersecretary Sherman.
To be a builder in the Middle East is not to view the region through rose-colored glasses. It is to understand that in a place with the Middle East's history, geography, and demographics, a healthy dose of tolerance and intercommunal give and take is essential. Efforts by one group to dominate all others, whether that group is a political party or an ethnic or religious faction, will never succeed for long. To be guided by hate is to go nowhere.
America's policy is to assist those who believe, as we do, that people of different nationalities, ethnicities, and creeds can live alongside one another constructively and in peace, said Undersecretary Sherman. That is our vision for the future. The Middle East, like other parts of the world, has its share of dividers and destroyers. The United States casts its lot with the problem solvers, the healers, and the builders.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.